This is Muse, science and exploration for inquisitive minds. This is the May-June 2024 edition. It's entitled A Little Help, and on the cover we have a variety of people who are helping each other, from a sprinter who's running on a prosthesis leg to little elves that are making the sign that says A Little Help. I'm Jane Malucci, a volunteer reader for Chris. The inside front cover has a picture of a pitcher plant with a bug trying to make a decision whether it should go in or not. It has a little speech bubble and it says, it smells too good in here to be true. Truth is, he could be risking his life. We'll find out on page 34. Flesh eaters or friends? Carnivorous plants and their animal partners. By Rebecca E. Hirsch. Page 10. A Measure of a Hero. Why Do Some People Risk Their Lives to Serve Others? By Diana Lynn. Page 20, Lending a Hairy Hand. How Chimps Help One Another Out? By Galadriel Watson. 29, Waste Not, Want Not, Turning Waste into Energy. By Lisa Christensen. Page 40, A Perfect Match. Seeking the Right Job for a Talented Dog. By Susan Roble. We begin on page 3 with Citizen Science by Maria Holohauskij. Science wants you. Volunteer, make real discoveries, and have a whole lot of fun. You may have heard about citizen science, but what is it, and why are some people, including scientists, so obsessed about it? Citizen science refers to any project where members of the public, everyday people, volunteer to help scientists. You may think of scientists as people who have all the answers. In reality, they're often working on involved projects that they can't complete alone. Dawn of a Good Idea. Back in 1999, researchers at SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, wanted to analyze data they had collected with radio telescopes. They didn't have a computer powerful enough to do the job, so they asked volunteers to help by using their home computers. The project was a huge success. Soon, other scientists began enlisting volunteers. Now, citizen scientists search satellite images for specks of stardust, find animals in photos snapped by motion sensor cameras, play puzzle games to imagine how complex proteins move and fold, and more. Many of these projects have led to important discoveries. More than 300,000 volunteers looked at pictures from the space telescope Kepler. Some of them discovered new planets. Feel like going outside instead? People have long contributed to scientific discovery by making observations about the world around them. Whether you have a passion for birds, beetles, frogs, fungi, clouds, or bacteria, there's probably a scientist who wants to record what you've been noticing. It's rewarding, too. Citizen scientists get to learn about cool subjects like biodiversity, space exploration, gene sequencing, and climatology by doing hands-on scientific research. And projects are often fun, playing games, observing nature, and looking at cool photos. You never know where your volunteering might lead. 3 volunteers in Norway, 2 scuba divers, and a photographer teamed up to help scientists find and photograph local nudibranches, a type of sea slug. Thanks to their years of hard work, scientists discovered 3 new species that had never been seen before. In return, they named the nudibranches after the citizen scientists. Could you be next? Find your project. Browse a variety of citizen science projects to find one you love. Here are a few places to start. SCIstarter.com, Zooniverse.org, science.nasa.gov/citizen-scientist. Page 7, Muse News by Elizabeth Preston. One of these stories is false. Can you spot which one? The answer is on page 46. At the top of the page, we have a picture of a beluga whale. Squee! Beluga learns to speak dolphin. Making friends when you move to a new home can be tough. One beluga whale found a good way to do it. Learn a new language. The female beluga moved to a new aquarium a few years ago. In her old tank, she swam with other belugas. But in her new tank, the only other animals were four dolphins. Using underwater microphones, researchers studied the sounds the beluga made in her new tank. At first, they heard all kinds of squeaks and chatter that are typical for belugas. One of those sounds, a contact call, is a way for belugas to check in with their friends and family. 2 months later, the researchers eavesdropped on the beluga again. She had stopped making her contact calls, but she had started imitating the unique whistles of her dolphin companions. The scientist thinks the beluga learned dolphin calls so she could fit in with their social group. Psychology. Why you should befriend Bigfoot. We talk about giving someone a helping hand, but maybe we should say a helping foot instead. A new study shows people with bigger feet are more helpful than those with petite feet. Researchers were inspired to look for a connection by a famously helpful professor at their university who also has enormous feet. They measured the height and foot size of more than 400 students and staff at the school, and they used questionnaires to ask about people's personality traits, including helpfulness. To make sure they got the truth about a person, researchers also had a friend or family member fill out a questionnaire about them. People with especially large feet for their height were found to be more helpful than those with average or small feet. The scientists aren't sure why. Maybe the hormones that affect our growth also increase the size of brain areas that make us more sociable, they say. Or maybe big-footed people have evolved to be extra helpful so others don't bully them about their extra large feet. Paleontology. Vegetarian dinos cheated on their diets. Some dinosaurs, like T-Rex, were hunters. Others were plant-eaters or herbivores. These dinos had teeth and jaws specially built for grinding up leaves. But now scientists know that herbivores weren't all strict vegetarians. Some ate shellfish. The discovery came from fossilized poop about 75 million years old. Researchers found the ancient turds in Utah. The poop fossils, also called coprolites, are large and packed with woody plant matter. That means they likely came from herbivores. But researchers found something else inside the fossilized poop. Shells. The shells probably belong to crustaceans, such as ancient crabs. Other crustaceans today include shrimp and lobsters. Back when dinosaurs lived here, a sea covered part of Utah. Scientists think the dinos munched on rotten logs in which crustaceans lived, but they may not have dined on seafood year-round. Maybe female dinosaurs ate shellfish when they needed extra protein and calcium to make eggs, the researchers say. Animal intelligence. Raccoons crack an old puzzle. Aesop's fables are stories from ancient Greece about animals learning lessons. In The Crow and the Pitcher, a thirsty bird finds a jug of water but can't reach far enough inside to drink. By dropping stones into the pitcher, the crow raises the water level until it can get a sip. Scientists have used a test like this to study the intelligence of real crows and their relatives. They found that some birds can solve the puzzle as well as human kindergartners can. And now, raccoons have solved it too. Researchers tested 8 raccoons. First, they showed the animals a clear cylinder of water with marshmallows floating just out of reach. They put small stones on the edge of the cylinder. If a raccoon accidentally knocked stones into the water, the marshmallows would float higher. 2 of the 8 raccoons eventually learned to drop stones in the water on purpose. A third raccoon solved the puzzle a different way. She knocked over the entire heavy tube to get the marshmallows out. Tech desk. Robotic skin changes texture. To design a new shape-shifting material, scientists took inspiration from octopuses. These animals and their relatives are masters of camouflage. They can change colors to match many underwater backgrounds. They can also change the texture of their skin, becoming spiky to blend in with a coral, for example. Octopuses change textures by using muscles to squeeze round bumps on their skin, making them bulge outward. To mimic this octopus ability, scientists combine stretchy silicone and stiff mesh. Using these materials is a lot like twisting a balloon or tying a string around it as you blow it up, the scientists say. An ordinary balloon will just turn out round, but a balloon squeezed in some way will form a different shape, like an animal balloon does. The researchers inflated the robotic surface to make it look like a pile of stones. In another test, they inflated the artificial skin to match a succulent plant. That's the news. Go to page 46 to see if you spotted the false story. Answers, page 7 to 9, Muse News. The false story is, why you should befriend Bigfoot. Page 10, The Measure of a Hero, by Diana Lynn. Why do some people risk their own lives to save others? Sam Olliner was 12 years old when German soldiers, Nazis, swept through his Polish village. The Nazis ordered all Jews to quickly pack a few belongings and then moved them into a crowded, sealed-off neighborhood 10 miles, 16 kilometers away. 2 miserable months of near starvation passed. Then the Nazis came again at dawn. They yelled and pounded on Sam's door. His stepmother told him, "Run away, my child, so that you will live." Still in his pajamas, Sam ran and hid on the roof. From up high, he watched the soldiers load everyone else onto trucks and drive away. It was 1942, and World War II was tearing Europe and his family apart. "I will help." The next day, Sam snuck back down to their rooms. His mother had died when he was 7. Sam wanted the only photo of her, but he couldn't find it. He grabbed clothes and set out on his own. With nowhere to go, Sam wandered around alone. He slept in barns and ate fruit he found in orchards. After a few days, he decided to walk to a village where he knew of a woman named Balvina, who had gone to school with his father. He knocked on her door. She immediately recognized him. She'd heard that Nazis had murdered all the Jews from his neighborhood. Balvina said, "You poor boy. I will help. You must live." The Nazis killed anyone who helped Jews, but she still took Sam inside. Balvina and her family risked their own lives to hide him. She taught him how to pray like a Catholic, and she changed his Jewish name to a Polish one. Sam made up a story about an imaginary Polish family and went out to work as a farmhand. He passed as non-Jewish for the next 3 years until the defeat of the Nazis. After the war, Sam made his way to the United States. He became a citizen, served in the U.S. Army, and went to college. Sam always remained grateful to Balvina. Before he left Poland, he says, "She gave me a little lecture saying I must tell the world about this barbarism. Today, people refer to the Nazis' large-scale murder of Jews and other groups as the Holocaust." Turning to science, Sam Olliner never stopped wondering why Balvina and her family saved him. Most people would have turned him away. Some would have given him to the Nazis. He read about other rescuers, too. What separates these heroes from everyone else, he wondered. He needed to know. To find out, Olliner became a social scientist, obtaining a Ph.D. degree from the University of California, Berkeley. For many years, he researched social behavior with his wife, Pearl Olliner, an education professor. Both worked at Humboldt State University in Northern California. Social scientists, like all scientists, use precise methods. They start out describing a problem. Then they do studies. Finally, they explain how they reached their conclusions. One big difference, though, is social scientists research real people and communities instead of conducting science experiments in laboratories. They often gather statistical evidence. Olliner started with his big question. How did Balvina and thousands of other heroic rescuers like her differ from people who stood by and did nothing during the Holocaust? To find out, he and Pearl Olliner devised a study to compare rescuers to non-rescuers. First, they located 800 rescuers plus a sample of non-rescuers or bystanders. Using careful methodology, they matched the two groups by age, sex, education, and location during World War II. The Olliners, or members of their research team, traveled to everyone's homes. With the help of local researchers, they interviewed subjects in their own languages, French, German, Italian, Polish, and Norwegian. Following that, the Olliners compared the two groups. In the process, Olliner found more than answers. By the time they'd each passed away in 2021, Sam and Pearl Olliner had interviewed close to 1,000 rescuers. He said that through it all, I grew more indignant about evil and in my small way could do something about it. The results of this research are published in the Olliner's book, The Altruistic Personality, Rescuers of Jews in Nazi Europe. Altruism means exceptional unselfishness. It reports that rescuers felt a greater sense of responsibility for the well-being of others. They tended to trust people, to think well of themselves and others, and to include people. Non-rescuers, on the other hand, tended to be suspicious and insecure, to focus on themselves, and to feel responsible to only a small group. Pearl Olliner points out that non-rescuers aren't necessarily bad people. Often, they just feel powerless and don't know what to do. The Olliner scientific research showed altruism can be taught. Rays of hope. Remember what Balvina said to Sam Oliver as he was leaving Poland? She asked him to tell the world about this barbarism. He did just that. He taught, wrote books, and lectured in many countries. His work has influenced others to do more research. In 1982, Sam and Pearl Olliner founded the Altruistic Personality and Pro-Social Behavior Institute in California. It continues to study and promote unselfish behavior while helping people in their own community. Once the Olliners' research showed how to encourage altruism, Sam Olliner added a message about creating a better world. In a video by the USC Shoah Foundation Institute describing his experience of the Holocaust, Olliner says, "In the midst of evil are rays of hope." Olliner's final book, What Kind of Future Will Our Children Inherit?, was published in 2021. The same year he died. A few years before, he was asked what advice he might have for young people. He replied that he would like them to learn about the consequences of indifference to other people's troubles. He said, besides learning reading, writing, and mathematics in school, students should be taught about altruism. In spite of the horrors he witnessed as a boy, Olliner had hope for the future. He wanted us all to remember that it is possible to create a more cooperative and caring world. We just have to look beyond ourselves. Ordinary bravery. The rescuers interviewed by Sam and Pearl Olliner deeply cared about others, but they didn't consider themselves special. Kindness felt ordinary to them. They explained saving others as just what people do. We had to help these people in order to save them, not because they were Jews, but because they were persecuted human beings who needed help. I sensed I had in front of me human beings that were hunted down like wild animals. This aroused a feeling of brotherhood and a desire to help. My parents taught me to respect all human beings. Learn by doing. Want to practice altruism? Try these activities. Good news. Set up a place to post stories about acts of kindness. Put up everyone's stories and drawings. Add clippings from newspapers and magazines. Bystander or upstander. In a group, think of 20 problems, such as losing lunch money or falling down in front of others. Write each problem on a different card. One person draws a card and acts out that problem. Someone else comes in and acts out helping. Another comes in and acts out not helping. Afterward, talk about what happened and how it felt. Volunteers rock. Volunteers work for free because they want to make the world better. Some might help at a school. Others might volunteer at an animal shelter or hospital. Find some volunteers. Ask each one three things. What do you do? Why do you do it? How does it make you feel? Share their stories. One good thing. The Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison has lots of ideas for teaching kindness. This is a favorite. In a group, ask everyone to think about one good thing that happened today. It can be something simple. Maybe it's, "My lunch was delicious," or "I met someone new." Then say, "Think about your good thing. Notice how it feels inside your body." Wait a few moments. Let anyone who wants to share their good thing and tell how it feels inside. Hey, thanks! Assemble a group in a circle at the end of the day. Invite people one at a time to say, "Hey, thanks," to someone else. Then have them tell why. For example, "Hey, thanks, Mike, for showing me how to catch a ground ball." Diana Lynn is an educator and writer, lucky to live in the same Northern California town that the Olanders did. "It's so beautiful there," she says. "It must be the end of a rainbow." Page 16, Science at Work by Alice Andre Clark. J. Ranganathan, biologist and co-founder of SciFund Challenge. J. Ranganathan is a biologist who has studied rainforest conservation, but now he devotes his time to a different project. You may have heard about how crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter and GoFundMe are helping people raise money for medical care, charity work, new businesses, or artistic projects like movies and board games. With crowdfunding, a lot of people each put a little bit of money towards solving a problem or making an exciting idea a reality. Ranganathan wants to do the same thing for scientific research. The organization he helped found, SciFund Challenge, is teaching scientists how to get better conversations going with the public. One goal is to convince average citizens to donate money to help scientists make amazing discoveries. What's SciFund Challenge, and what inspired you to start it? Another scientist and I noticed there were two problems in science. Problem one is that government research dollars got harder to come by. The second problem is that there's such a huge gap between science and society. And part of the reason for that problem is that scientists don't reach out to the public. We thought, wait a minute, these two problems actually have one solution, and that solution was crowdfunding. SciFund Challenge is focused on training scientists how to engage with the public. You don't just reach your hand out and ask for cash. No one likes that. The only way people give money to you for anything is if they care about you, and that care takes time to get. How do scientists get people to care about them and their work? They reach out on a regular basis with their material via public talks, blog posts, YouTube, social media. It doesn't matter what they're doing. What does matter is that they do it on a regular basis so they build an audience. And that's not to say scientists have to be there every day, but they do have to be there consistently. Then, every so often, say once a year, they have their own pledge drive, like the ones we hear on public radio. There was one anthropologist who wrote a blog about a TV show and how each episode got the anthropology right and wrong. She had a huge audience, and she raised $10,000 for her research. A microbiologist who was studying bacteria engineered them so they glowed. The reward for donors was that if you gave her $25, she would take a picture of your glowing name or whatever you wanted to glow. So people who aren't scientists may be playing a bigger role in deciding which scientific projects to fund. How would you go about deciding whether to support a project? I'd want to see first that there's a long track record of trying to reach out to people. If the researchers have been doing a lot of magazine articles, if they care about connecting me to the science, I'd say that's a very important thing. If the person is studying birds, are they presenting things about birds to non-experts? Second, you might think about whether the project makes sense with what you've learned in school about how science works. For example, there was a crowdfunding project where they were going to Africa to look for live dinosaurs. You might decide, well, I don't think that works. What can kids do to get involved in this new conversation between scientists and the public, in addition to reading Muse, of course? Kids can have their own presence on YouTube or in blogging about science. Are they professional scientists? No, but they're learning. Why can't they talk about what they've learned in middle school and high school? They know things their parents have long forgotten or never knew. Science and science communication aren't just for professionals. They're for everyone. 4 secrets for crowdfunding success. Would you like to get funding for a project of your own? Maybe an experiment, a film, or help for a friend in need? Plan your pitch. That's a short description of your project aimed at getting others to support it. Here are some steps you and your project partners can take to help your pitch stand out in a crowd. 1. Start networking. Jay Ranganathan thinks nothing is more important than to be involved in a community of people interested in science, whether it's through articles, videos, blogging, or social media. To generate traffic to your site, try commenting on online forums relevant to your project, guest posting on blogs like yours, or posting interviews with experts who do projects like yours. When you've built a community and kept it up, it's time to make your pitch. 2. Get emotional. Donors say they like proposals that make them laugh or think or that touch their hearts. A lot of campaigns out there are competing for attention. Work on a pitch, a great video often helps, that captures people's hearts and minds in seconds. Try it out on family and friends. Not only can they give you feedback, but they may also be your first donors. 3. Make a plan. If you're going to use your resources wisely, you'll need a budget and a timeline and the right crowdfunding platform to make your pitch. Consider how each site calculates how much to charge and whether projects like yours are successful on that site. 4. Keep your donors involved. Don't just say thank you. Offer rewards. They can be as simple as a t-shirt or a button, but you can get more creative for big donors, a big part in your film, or their names in glowing bacteria. But make sure that your rewards are things you can actually accomplish. Donors care about your project. Keep them updated, ask their advice, and suggest they contact their friends about your project. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Alice Andre Clark is a writer who loves reading about science and who appreciates that scientists like Jay Ranganathan are helping to make more scientists' work easier for non-scientists to understand. Page 19, Do the Math by Ivars Peterson. Coins in a row. Tip, to win the game, think over your first move. Simple, two-player games can be fun. They also let you try out strategies that may later help solve difficult problems. Try this game. Place an even number of coins in a line. Use coins of various values. You and another player take turns removing a coin from either end of the line until there are none left. The winner is the player who collects the most money. If you're using U.S. coins, you could create a row of 6 coins using a penny, a nickel, a dime, a quarter, a half dollar, and a dollar, placed in any order. In this case, the winner will be the player who gets the dollar because the other coins, taken together, total less than a dollar. How would you make sure you get the dollar? If you go first, one strategy would be to check the ends of the line and pick the larger of the 2 coins available on each turn. To mathematicians and computer scientists, such an approach is known as a greedy algorithm, and it works a lot of time, but not always. For instance, suppose the coins were in this order: 10, 50, 1, 5, 100, 25. If both you and your opponent followed the greedy approach, you would end up with 25 plus 10 plus 5 equals 40, and your opponent would get 100 plus 50 plus 1 equals 151. You lose. So, what could you do to win if you go first? Think about what your opponent's move will be at each step and work backward to figure out what to do. In this case, to keep your opponent from getting the dollar, you would select the dime first. You would earn 10 plus 1 plus 100 equals 111, and your opponent would get 50 plus 5 plus 25 equals 80. Can you think of a foolproof strategy that would lead to a win, or at least a tie, no matter what even number of coins you have? Try this. Add up the values of the coins in the odd positions, then add up the values of the coins in the even positions. If the total of the odd position coins is greater, take the leftmost coin first. Then choose a coin that was originally in an odd position on each later turn. If the total of the even position coins is greater, start by taking the rightmost coin. Then, take a coin that was originally in an even position on later turns. Following that strategy guarantees you won't lose, but it's not the full answer. You might need a different approach to make sure you get the highest possible total. Testing ways to sort through huge numbers of possibilities to find the best answer is part of what computer scientists and programmers do. Want to think like them? Figuring out ways to win simple games is a great place to start. Ivars Peterson is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of The Mathematical Tourist. He enjoys applying the greedy algorithm to rows of cookies. Page 23, Lending a Hairy Hand by Galadriel Watson. Chimpanzees are similar to humans, even when it comes to helping. Helping other people is super nice, but also sometimes selfish. Today at lunch, I may give you a handful of my pretzels, secretly hoping that tomorrow you'll give me a bite of your chocolate bar. Or maybe I volunteer to play tuba for the school band, knowing I'll get to go on a cool trip. Helping others out feels great, but would it be as wonderful if I wasn't going to benefit too? Let's ask the chimps. Chimpanzees are humans' closest living relatives, and they've also been known to help one another. They sometimes hunt together, share food, or groom one another. But what if the favor won't be returned? Or worse yet, there's an actual cost to helping out. Would a chimp still do it? Thanks, Ty. Meet Ty. She's a chimp who lives in the Wolfgang Kohler Primate Research Center in Germany. She was trained to help out other chimps, so researchers could see if those chimps would help her out in return. In one version of the experiment, Ty didn't do much of anything. She stood outside a small metal booth. On the opposite side of the booth stood another chimp. For some of the trials, this was a chimp named Kofi. Inside the booth were 2 choices of food. By pulling on various ropes, Kofi could give himself 4 pieces of food and give Tai none, or give both Tai and himself 3 pieces of food. Not surprisingly, Kofi almost always picked the selfish option and took the 4 pieces of food for himself. Then researchers had Tai take a chance. She got first choice of the food bowls. But rather than selecting food, she pulled on a rope that opened a latch. This allowed Kofi to decide who got what food instead. Tai was trained to take this action, but Kofi didn't know that. To him, it looked like Tai had taken a big risk, perhaps not getting any food at all, by letting Kofi pick. In this case, Kofi didn't always take all the food for himself. Instead, he often chose option number 2, which gave both him and Tai some food. This action was called pro-social, meaning he acted to benefit Tai as well as himself. The kicker is that he chose number 2 even though it meant he got less food. If he had chosen number 1, he would have gotten 4 pieces. By paying Tai back for her risky decision, he got only 3. All in all, the researchers studied 6 chimps with 24 trials each. 40% of the time, a chimp gave Tai some food when she took this risk, even though that chimp would get 1 fewer piece of food for themselves. "This doesn't sound like much," says lead researcher Martin Schmelz at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. But it is actually amazing because it has been believed for a long time that chimps will always be selfish when it comes to giving up food for someone else. The generosity might have to do with oxytocin. In humans and chimps alike, this hormone makes us bond with and care for one another. Schmelz says it might be possible that the act of seeing Tai pulling that rope and releasing that latch made the subject chimps feel good about her. That could explain why they chose the more generous option. Wild about patrolling. A group of wild chimpanzees is on the move. In single file, they walk toward the edge of their territory. They don't pause to eat, and they don't make noise. They're on the lookout for chimps from neighboring groups. If a strange chimp is on their turf, they'll let them know this is unacceptable, sometimes in violent ways. Or they may penetrate their neighbor's territory and claim that turf for themselves. There are several reasons male chimps cooperate to patrol like this. It keeps their territory and group members safe. It expands their territory, giving them more sources of food. And it can increase their group size when they gain access to neighboring females. But why volunteer to go on patrol? That's what Kevin Langegraber, an anthropologist at Arizona State University, wondered. He says, "Patrols can last a long time and cover long distances, so time spent patrolling is time that you're not feeding or mating with females." To better understand why a chimp might give those things up, Langegraber helps conduct a 20-year study on chimps living in Kibali National Park in Uganda, Africa. Not surprisingly, a lot of the males that went on these patrols had a selfish reason. They had children. Keeping their youngsters safe and well-fed was a good reason to volunteer. Most volunteers were also among the healthier, stronger members of the group. Long days spent patrolling weren't as hard on them. But some of the weaker males, who didn't have young, also patrolled. Why did they bother? There wouldn't be any punishment if they didn't participate, so why not simply spend the day eating like they normally would? The researchers theorized these males were looking toward their futures. Eventually, almost all of them had babies. Volunteering helped make the group healthier right away, which made it healthier later on, too. Langegraber said the chimps help patrol because even if you have nothing to gain from it now, and even if the costs are high, in the long run it will pay off. A lengthy history. Through studies like these, researchers have shown that chimpanzees make complex decisions when it comes to cooperating. They consider whether another chimp has taken a risk to help them, or look far ahead to see if the benefits of working together will come to them, too. And understanding chimps, our closest relatives, may help us understand ourselves. Chimps are one of the few species that cooperate to kill individuals from other groups. Their patrols are similar to humans waging war. If we as a society want to decrease things like warfare, says Longergraber, the first step is to understand them. The fact that humans and chimps are two species that cooperate also points to this being a behavior we've both been doing for a long time. Schmeltz says, it can be argued that if we find similarities between these species, then our last common ancestor also already behaved in that way. Differences probably only evolved later, and we can then think about what happened in our evolutionary history that caused these differences. Overall, Schmeltz says humans are probably more pro-social than chimps. In another version of the food experiment, when Ty hadn't risked anything and Kofi got the same amount of food either way, he didn't seem to care whether Ty got food or not. If Kofi were human, he might have been more generous more often and given Ty food too, or so we'd like to think. So, yeah, help yourself to a handful of my pretzels. Then I'm off to band practice. Just remember, please, to bring that chocolate bar tomorrow. Canadian writer Galadriel Watson, whose first name comes from the series The Lord of the Rings, was excited to hear one of the German chimps was named Frodo, which comes from the same books. This seems like more proof that humans and chimps are closely related. Page 29, Waste Not, Want Not, by Lisa Christensen. Turning waste into energy. People throw out a lot of garbage, but there are some places where waste is worth its weight in gold. Howling's Tomatoes is a business that grows and sells greenhouse vegetables. Company chairman Casey Howling runs the business. He has always been interested in making sure the company's greenhouses really are green, meaning friendly to the environment. A green business may use fewer resources than similar businesses, or make a very low level of carbon dioxide, CO2, and other air pollutants. These pollutants are sometimes called greenhouse gases because they trap warm air in Earth's atmosphere like a roof traps warm air in a greenhouse. In recent years, Howling's took the green concept a step further, says David Bell, a spokesperson for the company. Good neighbors. The company decided to search for a new place to build a greenhouse that would let them capture and reuse industrial heat and CO2 waste to grow tomatoes year-round, he says. Mona, a small town in the central region of Utah, was exactly what the company was looking for. After 3 years of planning, Howling's built a greenhouse next door to a power plant. The power plant creates electricity by burning natural gas. Besides electricity, the process produces heat and carbon dioxide. Before Howling's came to town, these were considered waste products. Howling's worked with the owner of the power plant, a company called Rocky Mountain Power, to funnel the extra heat and carbon dioxide into the greenhouse. The heat keeps the greenhouse toasty warm during cold Utah winters, and the tomatoes grow faster because the carbon dioxide helps fertilize them. Rocky Mountain Power provides electricity for customers in Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho. The plant in Mona is what's called a combined cycle power plant. That means that it initially burns natural gas to turn two big turbines, which look like the fans in a jet engine. They're connected to a generator. When the turbines turn, they create electricity through the generator. The exhaust from that process is sent to what's known as a heat recovery steam generator, where the extra heat boils water to create steam. The steam turns another turbine, which produces electricity through the generator too. Combined cycle power plants can create up to 50% more electricity than simple cycle power plants. In simple cycle power plants, electricity is generated only by burning natural gas, without using the extra heat to boil water and produce more electricity with the steam. Combined cycle power plants are also known to be reliable, an important quality for energy producers. Customers are counting on the lights turning on when they flip the switch. As customer needs increase, we have to increase our generation. And as customer needs decrease at night, we have to decrease our output, says Dave Eskelin, a spokesperson for Rocky Mountain Power. I like to say electricity is the only product that is manufactured and delivered in the same instant the customer asks for it. Eskelin says the process of siphoning off the waste heat and carbon dioxide doesn't affect the power plant at all, and the company's leaders were happy to work with Howlings. Capturing the waste carbon dioxide and heat means that original material used by the power plant gets a third use. Our company has a long interest in environmental responsibility, he says. Our first and highest duty is to supply our customers with electricity, so we don't do a lot of cutting-edge or experimental work in that area. But when another company had an innovative green idea, Rocky Mountain Power signed up. Heat plus power. Reusing waste is a smart recycling practice in general. Using the leftover heat from the power generator has a term and history all its own. Cogeneration, or combined heat and power, CHP. Although it's uncommon in the U.S. today, it's not a new idea. In 1882, American inventor Thomas Edison used the idea of CHP in the very first commercial power plant, Pearl Street Station in New York City. CHP works well when a power plant is near its customer for leftover heat, such as the Howlings greenhouse. The idea stuck around through the early years of commercial electricity, but grew less popular as consumers began to demand more and more power, and companies started building larger, more centralized power plants to produce enough electricity to keep up. But because CHP plants tend to be more complex to build, simpler forms of power generation ruled. Garbage to burn. But in Europe, CHP is much more widely used, especially in Sweden. There, the fuel of choice is not natural gas, but garbage. People in this Scandinavian country recycle most of their household waste. Anything that can't be reused or recycled is burned for heat and hot water for millions of people. In 2016 alone, the country burned nearly 2.3 million tons of household waste for energy. They're so efficient with recycling or reusing waste that they sometimes don't have enough of their own waste to burn and get more from other countries, which pay Sweden for the service. But all of this didn't happen overnight. Sweden started burning garbage for heat and energy in 1904. Through the 20th century, officials encouraged residents to separate recyclables. In the 1970s, 38% of household waste in Sweden was recycled. Today, more than 99% of Sweden's waste is recycled or burned in power plants. By comparison, in 2018, the last year that data is available, Americans recycled just 32% of their household waste. Anna Karen Gripwall, the communications director for Swedish Waste Management, says Sweden is so good at recycling in part because the government has worked hard to make recycling easy and to tell people why it's important. If you can give them the reason why they should recycle, they're more likely to do so, Gripwell says. When everyone communicates the same thing, it gives more impact. Recycled paper becomes new paper products, recycled plastic becomes new plastic products, and recycled food scraps turn into compost and dirt. About half of household waste can't be recycled into new things, so it's burned for energy instead. The fires heat water, which generates electricity and also helps heat homes. Because burning is a dirty process, the smoke runs through a series of air filters before it escapes the plant. Though some might think otherwise, Gripwell says, basically what comes out of the chimney stacks is water. The dirty air filters are even reused afterward. They help fill abandoned mines. Worth a second look. The United States is far from Sweden's rate of recycling and tends to use different fuel sources, but the efficient combined cycle power plant is common here, and some American companies are looking at CHP again. Howlings, the greenhouse attached to the power plant, expanded its size in recent years. As of 2021, it could grow 750 acres worth of tomatoes with a fraction of the resources. Bell says it's able to do more with the heat and carbon dioxide from the power plant. Turning greenhouse gases into greenhouse vegetables? Sounds like a pretty tasty plan. Lisa Christensen lives in Salt Lake City, Utah, and has eaten tomatoes grown from energy plant CO2. They are delicious. Page 34, Flesh Eaters or Friends by Rebecca E. Hirsch. We have a cartoon drawing of Kate and what appears to be a flesh-eating plant. The plant says, "Care to join me for lunch, Kate?" And she says, "I'd be delighted tomorrow or the next day." Carnivorous plants and their animal prey and partners. A hungry fly zips through a steamy jungle on the island of Borneo. The fly is on the trail of a fruity smell, the smell of dinner. The fly lands on the leaf of a pitcher plant. The vase-shaped leaf is filled with fluid and topped with a lid that is partially ajar. The fly walks along the slippery rim of the pitcher. The fly takes a wrong step and whoops! It tumbles into the pitcher. The watery fluid begins to digest the body of the drowning insect. The fly has just become a meal for one of Borneo's meat-eating pitcher plants. Borneo is a dangerous place for an insect. The large mountainous island in Southeast Asia is home to dozens of species of pitcher plants. Some dangle like lanterns from the branches of trees. Some rest on the ground amid the grasses and ferns. Pitcher plants are carnivorous, eating bugs and other small animals to survive. Any insect that flies or crawls near the pitchers could end up as the plant's next meal. Slippery pits of doom. Like all plants, pitcher plants make their own food through photosynthesis. They use sunlight to turn carbon dioxide and water into sugars that provide energy to the plant. But all plants also need other nutrients like nitrogen. Most plants absorb this nutrient from the soil through their roots, but the soil on the mountain slopes of Borneo is low in nutrients, so pitcher plants can't get much nitrogen through their roots. Instead, they draw nitrogen from the bodies of animals. An insect that lands on the slippery rim of a pitcher plant can lose its balance and fall in. The pitcher walls are also slippery, so the insect can't escape. Inside the pitcher is a mix of rainwater, acid, and digestive enzymes. This lethal liquid breaks down the bodies of prey so the plant's walls can absorb them. The pitcher trap works so well, these plants can catch and devour insects, spiders, centipedes, and many other invertebrates or animals without backbones. And yet, despite the obvious dangers, some of Borneo's animals benefit by living closely with the flesh-eating killers. No escape. A cockroach walks along the mouth of a pitcher plant, Nepenthes bicalcarata. A pair of thorny spikes gives the pitcher its monster-like appearance and its common name, the fanged pitcher plant. The cockroach loses its footing on the slippery rim and splashes into the water below. When that happens, diving ants pour out of a hole in the pitcher plant's stem, ready for action. One ant jumps into the pitcher to fetch the drowning cockroach. Other ants wait along the edge, ready to help haul the creature from its watery grave. But this isn't a rescue mission. The ants promptly tear the cockroach to bits and devour it. Diving ants are adapted to live with fanged pitcher plants. The ants are able to walk across the slippery rim without falling in. They can even swim and dive in the digestive fluids. The ants live in hollow, swollen stems of the fanged pitcher plant. The ants gain a safe home and a ready supply of food, feasting on the prey that falls into the pitcher and licking sweet nectar from the plant. But the fanged pitcher plants benefit from the relationship too. Although it might appear that the ants are robbing the pitcher of food, that's not really true. Research shows that fanged pitcher plants that live with diving ants grow more quickly than those without diving ants. So how exactly do the ants help their plant host? A team of scientists set out to find the answer. Using a traceable form of nitrogen, the scientists tracked the nitrogen's path from the diving ants to the fanged pitcher plant. They found that when diving ants feast on insect prey, they leave their nitrogen-rich droppings in the pitcher, and the plant absorbs the nitrogen. When the ants die, their bodies tumble into the pitcher, and the plant digests them. Tree shrew toilet. Nepenthes raja, often called the king of the pitcher plants, makes unusually large football-sized pitchers. For a long time, the overgrown size of the pitchers was a mystery to plant experts. Since a small pitcher would work well for catching insects, spiders, and other small prey, why does the plant make such a large pitcher? The answer comes in its relationship with the mountain tree shrew. This squirrel-sized animal uses the plant as a toilet. The tree shrew clambers onto the pitchers, straddles the rim, and slurps sweet nectar from the underside of the lid. As it dines, the animal poops into the pitcher. In this symbiotic relationship, mountain tree shrews gain a source of food. The pitchers get regular deposits of nitrogen-rich feces. This relationship explains the size of the pitchers. When scientists measured the pitcher opening, they found that it perfectly matches the body size of tree shrews. Smaller pitchers simply wouldn't cut it as a toilet, as most droppings would land on the ground instead of inside the pitcher. The pitchers have another critical feature that makes them effective as a shrew toilet: a bowl-shaped lid. The lid of an N. raja pitcher is curved, with a coating of nectar inside, like an upside-down mixing bowl coated with frosting. Charles Clark of Monash University in Malaysia has studied the relationship. He says there is only one way mountain tree shrews can reach the nectar. They must climb onto the pitchers and orient themselves in such a way that their backsides are located over the pitcher mouths, he told BBC News. Mountain tree shrews are not alone in using N. raja as a toilet. Clark's team set up video cameras to see what else could be visiting the pitcher plants. They placed a thin plastic cup inside the pitcher to catch any droppings left inside. They discovered that mountain tree shrews visit the plants during the day, and summit rats arrive after dark. Like the tree shrews, summit rats straddle the pitcher, lick nectar, and deposit their nutrient-rich droppings. Poop isn't disgusting enough for this plant. It also eats bugs. The smell of rotting feces draws flies, which drown in the pitcher. Mountain tree shrews and summit rats themselves aren't free from danger. If a tree shrew or rat should accidentally tumble in, as sometimes happens, the pitcher plant is quite capable of devouring the unlucky creature. Bat hotel. Another species of pitcher plant, Nepenthes hemsleyana, has mostly given up its meat-eating habits. It makes its living mainly as a hotel for bats. When a hardwook's woolly bat flies through the jungle in Borneo, it calls out with high-pitched squeaks. The bat is echolocating, bouncing sound off objects and listening for the echo. In this way, the bat can find a place to roost in the dense, leafy jungle. When the bat calls, a pitcher plant shouts back with a distinctive echo, inviting the bat to roost inside it. The pitcher plant is adapted to reflect the bat's call back to it. The back wall of the pitcher is wide and curved like a satellite dish. Sound bounces easily off the curved surface. When a bat follows the plant's echo, it finds an ideal place to roost, protected from weather and free of parasites. As with diving ants and tree shrews, the roosting bat poops into the pitchers, feeding the plant the nitrogen it needs. Unlike other species of pitcher plants, N. hemsleyana has largely abandoned its carnivorous lifestyle. It is so well adapted for bats to roost inside that it is no longer good at catching prey. Its pitchers contain very little digestive fluid and catch far fewer insects than closely related species of pitcher plants. Instead, the plant is a super cozy bat toilet that survives by gobbling up waste. In some pitchers, bat youngsters snuggle beside their parents. The pitchers of N. hemseliana have evolved to perfectly fit the bat's body, says Carolyn Schroener. She's a zoologist at the University of Greifswald in Germany and has researched the relationship. The bat performs another service for the plants by pre-digesting insects and making the nutrients more accessible. Bats are better hunters than plants, Schroener explains. By giving up its hunting habits and instead catering to bats, the plant gets access to a wider variety of nutritious bugs. Pre-digested insects, also known as bat poop. Yum! It shows once again that Borneo's pitcher plants have unusual animal friendships and rather disgusting taste in food. Rebecca E. Hirsch finds carnivorous plants to be fiendishly clever. Her middle grade book, When Plants Attack, explores the dark side of the plant kingdom. Page 39, Q&A by Lizzie Wade. Question: why do certain colors look good together, but others clash? Mary Lynn W. Answer: first, imagine a rainbow. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, all laid out in a line. Now, pull that rainbow into a circle so that violet touches red. That circular rainbow is called a color wheel. Take a look at which colors are across from each other. Red and green, and blue and yellow. These pairs are called complementary colors. Something funny happens when you mix them together. Jay Neitz is a vision researcher at the University of Washington. He says if you shine a red light and a green light at the same spot, the mixture will look gray. The same goes for yellow and blue. They cancel each other out, Neitz says. This doesn't work with paint. Complementary paint colors turn muddy brown or black when mixed. He compares mixing opposite colors to adding sugar and lemon juice to water. The sweetness mellows out the sourness tones down the sweetness, and you end up with a perfect glass of lemonade. Now, think about another sweet-sour combination. Sweet candy encased in a layer of powder that's sour. The outer portion tastes mouth-twistingly tangy, but after you get through all that sourness, the candy seems even sweeter than it really is. The same goes for putting red and green next to each other, says Neitz. Looking at the red makes the green look more intense. Complementary colors look exciting together. Still, just a slight twist can transform a color pair from lovely to ugly. It turns out that the cells in our eyes that see color are most sensitive to green and yellow light. That means those colors usually look brighter to us than red and blue do, and people especially love bright greens and yellows with dark reds and blues. But if you put a dark green next to a bright red, people don't like that, Neitz says. It's just unnatural somehow. Go to an art museum and check out the different artworks. You'll definitely see complementary colors, but you'll find plenty of clashing color combinations too, and they might actually look pretty great. The color wheel isn't the last word. Paul Smith is an art historian at the University of Warwick in England. He says it's worth doing your own experiments to find your favorite color combos. In art, there are rules of thumb, but there are no rules. Lizzie. Have any questions? Email them with Muse Q&A in the subject line to muse@cricketmedia.com. Page 40, A Perfect Match by Susan Roble. Seeking the right job for a talented dog. I could hear the protest from the end of the hallway at Children's Hospital, Colorado. No, no! Nico's leg had been amputated after an injury. Nico's name has been changed. Now he had an artificial leg. His therapist wanted him to try to walk. "No," he shouted again. "It hurts." Hathaway, a therapy dog, had met Nico during earlier visits. I'm Hathaway's human partner. The dog took me to Nico's wheelchair. "Would you like to take Hathaway for a walk?" I asked. Nico stopped crying. He forgot about the pain. Instead, he reached for the leash and stood up. With Hathaway beside him, Nico left the wheelchair behind and walked. Then, standing and balancing on his brand new leg in the therapy gym, he played fetch with Hathaway, his Labrador Retriever friend. A therapist shook her head in disbelief. "When Hathaway's here," she said, "miracles happen." A black ball of fluff. In June of 2009, my family and I picked up an 8-week-old black ball of fluff from the airport. Hathaway was a Canine Companions for Independence, CCI, puppy. CCI provides highly trained service dogs free of charge to people with disabilities. We were her puppy raisers. For the next year and a half, we took her to puppy classes, taught her commands, and socialized her. She went almost everywhere with us. We took her shopping, to restaurants, and to museums. When she was about a year and a half old, Hathaway went to California for more training. She passed her advanced classes, but the professional trainers noticed that she no longer seemed happy and confident. She was showing signs of anxiety, like licking her lips and turning her head away. They knew that becoming a service dog was the wrong job for Hathaway. They asked if we would like her back. We said, yes. We were sad that she would not graduate and become a service dog, but we were also thrilled that she was coming back to us. The right job hunt begins. Full-time work as a service dog wasn't right for Hathaway, but she loved going out. She loved being around people. She was calm and smart and knew about 40 different commands. She had learned to work alongside wheelchairs and loved the command, visit. We needed to work together to find her a new job. Hathaway and I became a certified team with Pet Partners, an organization that registers therapy animals. We started volunteering with the Reading Education Assistance Dogs, READ program. A local school chose 2 students who needed help with reading. Each week they read to Hathaway for half an hour. Hathaway didn't judge them. She didn't laugh at mistakes. Her job was to cuddle and to listen. By the end of the year, the students who read to Hathaway were no longer behind. They loved the program, so did their teachers. But just like the professional CCI trainers in California, I noticed that Hathaway wasn't excited about her work. She did it, and she did it well, but she didn't really like being a reading dog. Her eyes didn't light up. Her tail wags were slow. We are a team. I wanted my partner to love her therapy work. Once again, it was time to find a different job. Ready for a test. Pet Partners had other opportunities for Hathaway. When human-animal teams are tested for therapy work, the dogs must be good with commands like sit, stay, and come. They must walk closely beside their handlers on a loose leash. They must recover quickly if there is a sudden noise. But the hardest part of the test, for many dogs, it is simply walking past another dog without pulling. A Pet Partners evaluator asked if Hathaway could work as a neutral dog. In this job, the neutral means not providing help or assistance. Hathaway would be the dog that the teams taking their test had to walk past. I agreed. As the human-dog teams being tested walked past us, Hathaway would look at me. By not looking at the other dogs, she made it easier for them to pass their test. I could tell that Hathaway enjoyed being a neutral dog. Her eyes shone. Her head was up. But the evaluations take place only a few times each year. It wasn't enough. We needed to find a more regular job. Airport allies. Staffers at nursing homes, colleges, and courthouses have asked Pet Partners if dogs can come visit. Petting animals helps people feel calm. It lowers heart rates and reduces blood pressure. United Airlines contacted Denver Pet Partners, too. The airline staff knew that for many passengers, traveling over the holidays is stressful. They started a program called United Paws. In cities all across the United States, therapy dogs come to airports over the December and spring holidays. Hathaway and I were part of the group that headed to Denver International Airport. Sometimes, passengers reached out for pats and hugs. For others, just seeing the therapy dogs put a smile on their faces. Hathaway liked the people and the excitement. But this was seasonal, temporary work. Our hunt for a permanent job continued. A prescription for pets. Children's Hospital Colorado also had a program for human-dog teams. The Prescription Pet Program at Children's Hospital Colorado was founded in 1984. It was the first program in the country where therapy dogs came regularly to visit kids in a hospital. Initially, doctors had to write prescriptions for the kids in the hospital to get dog visits. Now, therapy teams make rounds visiting children's rooms. Veterinarian Sarah Mark helped develop the Prescription Pet Program. She felt that Hathaway was a good fit for a special program in the hospital. She suggested working in the rehabilitation gym. Hathaway's job there would be to provide animal-assisted therapy, AAT. After a major injury, kids who need to relearn how to use their bodies may stay in a hospital for weeks or months. Rehab gyms in children's hospitals are full of toys, games, and kid-sized equipment designed to get bodies moving again. Dogs that work in AAT serve as another kind of tool. Therapists use the dogs to help motivate their patients and to get patients moving. Before going to the hospital, Hathaway takes a bath. I also brush her teeth, clean her ears, and trim her nails. In the parking lot, she gets another brushing. Then a special vest goes on. It covers Hathaway's body from her shoulders to her hips. The bath and brushing cut down on the amount of fur that might get on a patient. This helps reduce the possibility of allergic reactions. Many of the children in the rehabilitation gym are working on range of motion, stretching and retraining their muscles so they can reach or stand or walk. Hathaway's gym bag contains dog toys shaped like footballs, soccer balls, and basketballs. One ball has a bell inside it. Patients with limited eyesight can hear the ball even if they can't see it. The therapist tells me what each child needs. Many times, kids who play with Hathaway don't even realize that they are doing their therapy exercises. For Hathaway, it is hard work. The gym often hosts several patients at once. Each patient usually has two therapists and a family member or two along. Doctors came in and out of the room checking on patients. Sometimes, as many as 20 people occupy this small gym. Hathaway has to stay focused on just two people, me and the child she is working with right then, even if that means jogging past 10 other people to retrieve a ball. Hathaway loves doing animal-assisted therapy. I know because each time since that first session, she sits up in the car as we turn into the hospital parking garage. She quivers with excitement. Once her vest is on, she prances her way into the building. It took time, but our teamwork paid off. We found her the perfect job. Glossary of service animals. Guide dogs. Guide blind or visually impaired people. Hearing dogs. Alert their human partners to sounds. Service animals have been trained to do work or perform tasks to help people with a disability. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, only dogs can be service animals. A service animal must be allowed into restaurants, stores, hotels, and other public spaces. Skilled companion dogs work as part of three-member teams. A team is often a child with a disability, a parent, and a highly trained dog. Facility animals are assigned with human partners to places, facilities, where they work nearly full-time as members of teams. For example, A facility dog might live with a speech therapist and go with her each weekday to the school where she works. Emotional support animals, ESAs, help people with mental or emotional disability by being companions. These animals may be allowed in housing with no pets rules. They may travel with their owners. But ESAs do not have what is called public access. This means they are not allowed to go with their person to places like schools, restaurants, or stores. Therapy animals go with their handlers, their human partners, to places like schools, hospitals, and nursing homes. Therapy teams often volunteer for shifts of a few hours each week. At Pet Partners, a large therapy animal program registers cats, equines, horses, ponies, and miniature horses, rabbits, guinea pigs, llamas, and alpacas, birds, miniature pigs, and rats, in addition to dogs. Abby's match. 6-year-old Abby had an injury to her brain. In the rehab gym at Children's Hospital Colorado, therapists took Abby's hand and opened her fingers. Then they helped Abby pet Hathaway, running Abby's hand along Hathaway's fur. The warm fur helped Abby's fingers stay open. The therapist said Hathaway could help Abby begin to feel what she touched again. Abby's mother asked about Hathaway's training. She contacted Canine Companions for Independence. After applications and interviews, Abby was matched with a CCI skilled companion dog, a yellow lab golden retriever mix named Finn. Finn pushes buttons to open doors so Abby's wheelchair can get through. He snuggles beside her during therapy sessions. He pulls off her socks at night. And Abby takes care of Finn, feeding and brushing him. People in the service dog community sometimes say that each dog ends up where it was meant to be. If Hathaway hadn't found her perfect job, Abby and Finn wouldn't have found their perfect match. Susan Roble is a Denver-based writer with a passion for science, education, kids, and dogs. When she isn't writing, she is chauffeuring her 2 therapy dogs around to their perfect jobs. Page 47, Your Tech by Catherine Hulick, art by Matthew Billington. Do bionic limbs give athletes an unfair advantage? Marcus Rehm can leap much farther than the length of your family car. He's a world champion long jumper. But he only has one leg. He wears a device called a prosthesis in place of his missing leg. You'd think that a missing leg would cause problems, especially for an athlete. But the prosthesis Rehm wears is specially designed to propel him forward. It's a lightweight curved metal blade, some called Rehm Blade Jumper. At a 2015 competition for athletes with disabilities, he sailed 27.6 feet, 8.4 meters. That distance would have beaten the non-disabled gold medalist at the 2012 and 2016 Summer Olympics. Rehm wanted to compete in the 2016 Summer Olympics, but some thought his blade leg gave him an unfair advantage, and he couldn't prove that it didn't. Researchers have conducted extensive tests on the benefits of blade-shaped legs when it comes to running and jumping. The results are mixed. The main benefit of a blade leg is that it weighs much less than a typical leg and foot. That means an athlete can move the leg more quickly. One test on a sprinter who ran with 2 prosthetic legs showed that he could swing his legs 15% faster than other world-class athletes. The blade leg also has drawbacks, however. A real leg has many muscles and joints that all act independently. A runner can reposition all these parts as needed to make each stride more efficient. A prosthetic, though, is an entirely passive system, David Morgenroth of the University of Washington told Scientific American. That could be a disadvantage when you're trying to get up to speed as a runner. Over time, though, engineers will continue to improve blade legs and other bionic limbs. They may eventually offer as much or more efficiency compared to a real leg. What does Rehm think of all this? He just wants to do his best. I always said I want a fair competition, he told World Para Athletics. I don't want to have any advantage out of a prosthesis. I just want to do what I love and train really hard for outstanding performances. I don't want to say sorry for it. What do you think? Should athletes with blade legs compete alongside non-disabled athletes? This has been the May-June 2024 edition of Muse. I'm Jane Malucci for Chris.